Okay, we're going to be learning Bava Basra today, and we're going to make up for Moed Katan, which was for some reason not taped when we did it the last time. So we're going to start with Bava Basra, and then we'll have an extra bit of learning. Okay, I have one simple statement would undo maybe half of this Masechta. Is this, get it in writing. Okay, half of this Masechta is what happens when a contract, a partnership, an ownership, where something goes wrong, where there's a dispute over, well, who was responsible to make up for the extra month's rent? Who's responsible for who gets to keep the anchor on the ship? Who gets to keep the spare tire in the car? Now, today we have certain assumptions that when you sell something, certain things go along with it. In the Gemara, usually that's limited to the things that are attached to it, right? If you sell a ship, wouldn't you think that the anchor is sold? Not so fast. You should, when you buy a ship, you have to say the following: I buy the ship and everything in it. Otherwise, does that include the lounge chairs on the ship? Does that include the ping pong table in the ship? Well, you know, you have to say, you have to be more clear. We want clarity in commerce. We don't want any doubts about, let's say, roommates who are dividing rent between the three of them. And then there's a dispute when one of them wants to leave, or one of them is getting married, or whatever it is. And who's responsible for that rent? Does he continue to be responsible throughout the term of the rental? Is he responsible to replace himself? Are they responsible? You have to put all this in writing. Even the best of friends have to put everything in writing. Okay. So understandably, the very first chapter is called Perek HaShutfin, partnerships. Okay. That is the continuation from the end of Bava Metzia, which talked about, if you recall last week, the upstairs and downstairs neighbors. They're partners in that domicile, if you will. Now, it could be that one of them owns it and the other is renting. That could be. Or they're both renting from another person, right? But they do have some kind of a partnership, right? Might even be some shared space that they both have. Okay, there's also, if you recall, just about a week ago, we had Maseches Nedarim, where we reviewed, because that also didn't get taped. I mean, Nedarim also has a chapter called Perek HaShutfin. Okay, but here, this is all about partners in a backyard, partners in the house, partners in the business. And perhaps the most famous part of the chapter is in Daf Yudal and Tesvav, which has the earliest bibliography known to the world. Earliest bibliography. A bibliography of what? Naturally, of the Bible. Okay? Because the Gemara speaks about two people who own a Bible together, right? They own a Tanakh. They couldn't, each one couldn't afford it themselves, so they pooled their money and bought a full Tanakh, which was not such a common thing back then. And then now they want to divide their estates. They no longer get along and they want to split everything 50-50. How do you divide a Tanakh? Who gets what? Right? You get the Torah, I get the Nevi'im, we split the Ksuvim. What do? Tanakh has three parts to it. Right? How many books are in the Tanakh? Now this is where you get to the cool part. Not everyone agreed at the time of what is in Tanakh. Right? There were five books of Tanakh, Yechezkel, Esther, Mishlei, Shir HaShirim, and Koheles, whose canonicity was questioned. Does that get split? What about other books where some others tried to push into the Tanakh? Right? How does that work? All right. So, okay, so that's the first parak. Second parak is called Lo Yachpor, which means that you're not allowed to dig a pit too close to someone's tree. And you're also not allowed to plant a tree too close to someone's pit. You know, you have to be careful how when you do things, how it impacts on other people, on other people's property. Okay, be careful when you dig a cistern. You want to make sure you're not doing any damage to someone else's line. Okay, that's the second chapter. Third chapter is one of the longest chapters in the Masechta, and this is where Rashi did not complete his commentary to and his grandson Rashbam took over. Okay, so in there are a few masechtas like this, the end of Pesachim, right? And there are a few others where there's some scholarly opinions about whether Rashi actually wrote them, his commentary, the commentary that appears in his name on the Maseches Tainis, the Maseches Tzemura, possibly even the Maseches Nazir. I won't go into all that now, but Cheskas Abatim is where you start with Rashbam's commentary to Bava Basra. It's interesting because his commentary to the Torah is very terse, but his commentary to the Talmud is much longer than Rashi's, which is why Bava Basra is the largest Masechta in Shas. It is 176, goes to all the way to page 176, starts at page 2, so it's 175 pages. And the pages are often very, very small. The third chapter in Bava Basra has pages that are 10 lines, 8 lines, 6 lines, page after page, so because it's all Rashbam, it's all commentary, right? The pages that have very little Gemara are the hardest ones because you have to read this tiny print and big Tosfos and big Rashbams. Okay. All right. So the third parak is called Cheskes Abatim, where you don't have proof that you own this place, but you are considered the owner because you've been living there and acting as an owner. So this chapter is very important about creating what's known as a chazaka, meaning you create an assumption. You can't prove that I own this place, but there's an assumption that I own this place because I'm behaving like an owner and no one's challenging my ownership. Question comes, of course, when someone does challenge my ownership, right? You should hold on to a contract. Obviously, again, something went wrong. I don't have it in writing. Okay. Fourth and fifth and sixth chapters are all called in succession, Hamocher es Habayis, Hamocher es Hasfina, and Hamocher Peros. Means that when you sell a house, you sell a field, and I sell a ship, and you sell objects, there are certain assumptions of what's included in these things, right? The first two are when you sell a house, do you sell the well that's in the back? Do you sell all the movable items that happen to be in the backyard when you sell it? Right? You know, not so fast, not so clear. Right, you have to put everything in writing. What's included and what's not included? Does it include the walkway? Now, we have certain sensitivities about these things where we'd say, of course it must. How else is he going to get to his house? Then put it in writing. Okay, everything has to be in writing. No assumptions. Now, it's interesting because the third chapter is called Cheskes Abatim, creating assumptions. But we try to keep assumptions to a minimum. Put it in writing. Okay. Sixth chapter is Hamocha Peros, that when you sell items, we have to assume that when, let's say you sell 1,000 pounds of potatoes, that there might be mixed in with those potatoes some impurities. You sell, when you're selling grains, there might be some pebbles included, right? There might be some things that get harvested together with the grain. So the very minimum, but it does give a designation of how much impurities are allowed. Very, very small percentages, of course, but some percentages. Okay. And that's actually the topic goes into the seventh chapter as well. The eighth chapter is about inheritance law. All right. There could be disputes there too, between siblings, right? Okay. And between some people who all of a sudden come out of the woodwork and say, I'm your half brother. We share a father. He goes, I never heard of you. He goes, well, I happen to be, here's my papers, here's my proof, right? So he is the second guy who gets to share the, you know, the inheritance, right? He has to prove it beyond the shadow of a doubt. The ninth and tenth chapters are all about contracts. Okay? Contracts that are set aside for people who feel they're about to die and they feel that they can't get the testimony and the witnesses in time to make a will. So what they say just by word of mouth, as long as they're of sound mind in front of witnesses, counts as a will, right? The last chapter is all about wills. And the ninth chapter is about wills. The tenth chapter is all about all different kinds of contracts. Okay? That is Bava Basra. And again, the whole thing could probably be, half of it can be obviated if you just put everything in writing. Remember that in business. Okay. Now we're going to make up for Moed Katan. Moed Katan is just three chapters, and it teaches the laws of Moed Katan, meaning Chol HaMoed. The holidays are the big Moedim. That's the Moed Gadol, right? The Chol HaMoed between the first and last days of holidays is what we call Moed Katan. Okay? In the Torah, it just says Bayom HaRishon Mikra Kodesh, Bayom HaShvi'i Mikra Kodesh for Pesach. Bayom HaRishon Mikra Kodesh, Bayom HaShmini, Shmini Atzeres, which is actually a new holiday, that's not part of Sukkot anymore, is also our Mikra Kodesh. The Gemara in Megillah gives us a nice, interesting benchmark. It says that Shabbos, which is the holiest day, has seven aliyahs. Down from that is Yom Kippur, because it's a Yontif, but you can't cook because you can't eat. So that has six aliyahs. Yontif, which is regular Yontif, including Rosh Hashanah, where you can cook, so that has five aliyahs. Chol HaMoed and Rosh Chodesh, which are not Yontif, but they have Musaf, it's four aliyahs. And every other day, every other laning is three aliyahs. So you see that the amount of aliyahs is in the sign of the holiness of the day. So Chol HaMoed is obviously not as holy as Yontif. What I mean by that is that you would have to lose your job rather than work on Yontif, but you don't have to lose your job rather than work on Chol HaMoed. Even though the rabbis were very strict about not doing unnecessary work on Chol HaMoed, in fact, a few places in Shas, especially a mission in Pirkei Avos, that says, HaMavazes HaMoedos, if someone disparages and misuses the holiness of the holidays, right? So he says Ein lo chelik l'olam haba. It's a dogmatic aveira. You don't lose your olam haba for working on Shabbos. You don't lose your olam haba for working on Yom Kippur. But Rashi says you do lose your olam haba for working on Chol HaMoed, because to work on Shabbos just means that you're violating Shabbos. You're not following a mitzvah. To work on Chol HaMoed means you don't trust the dogmatic, if you will, the interpretation, the rabbinic interpretations of the Torah Shebaal Peh. Right? Chagiga Daf Yud Ches gives many different drushes from the Torah about how we know that Chol HaMoed has that special characteristic. Right? Again, work is allowed on Chol HaMoed. It's just that it has to be something that is Tzorach HaMoed, or that he'll suffer a great loss if he doesn't. Okay, so the first chapter teaches various allowances so that he doesn't lose his field, he doesn't lose his, the field doesn't dry out, right? So the very first Mishnah talks about how you're allowed to water or divert certain tributaries to water your property in order to save it from being lost. Some of these issues are shared with the Shemitah year, because you're also not allowed to work the land in the Shemitah year, but you don't have to watch your land get washed away or wiped away or parched so that it can't produce anything the year after. You're allowed to do certain things on Shemitah year for the land, just as you're allowed to on Chol HaMoed. All right, so the first chapter talks about all those things that you're allowed to do that might involve even a little tircha, even a little activity, and malacha, because in order to refrain from suffering a terrible loss, right? And the Gemaras tell us what's the nature of the loss. The loss isn't $5. The loss has to be something that's, you know, it's more significant. People often ask, can I go shopping on Chol HaMoed? Okay, if it's a you need a suit because your brother's getting married and the suit is on sale right now and it's not going to be on sale afterwards. All right, you suffer a few hundred dollars loss. Maybe that's considered a big loss for you. All right, but someone who goes out to dinner every night and spends $500 for dinner, and then it's disingenuous to say I have to go shopping because I want to save myself a $150 loss. All right, it all has to be, you know, according to you ask a question and you get a good answer. All right, so here it also says that on Chol HaMoed, we shouldn't get married because Ein Marvin Simcha B'Simcha. We shouldn't mix the Simcha of Chol HaMoed with other Simchas. Concentrate on Chol HaMoed itself. Don't mix the Simcha of Chol HaMoed with other Simchas. You can't get married on Shabbos or Yom Tov, that's for sure, because that involves Isser, because we have to make a kinyan to get married. You have to pass over a ring and require something, and right? So you can't do that on Shabbos or Yom Tov. But on Chol HaMoed, you're allowed to make acquisitions, so if necessary. But still, we shouldn't get married because of this. The other reason, which is we don't want to mix the simcha. Second chapter talks about things that had already started before Yom Tov, and if he would not continue it, he didn't mean for it to interrupt Yom Tov. He just thought he would be able to finish before Yom Tov, and he didn't. So if he would leave the work undone, like in the middle of a harvest of grapes or olives or something, or in the middle of squeezing the grapes and olives in the vat, and if he would stop right there and wait till after the Yom Tov and Chol HaMoed and the last days of Yom Tov, they would all spoil. So of course he can't do that on Yom Tov. You've got to lose your job, and no loss, no monetary loss justifies working on Shabbos at Yom Tov, right? But on Chol HaMoed will allow, because it's a davar avod if he doesn't finish the harvest and doesn't finish the vat. Okay, and of course anything else that is needed for the moed itself. He has no food for Shmini Atzeres. Of course, he can shecht an animal and do shopping on Chol HaMoed for the sake of the last days of it. Right? What the rabbis wanted to refrain from, this ends the second parak, what the rabbis wanted to refrain from was any intentional work done on Chol HaMoed, because, well, I don't have too many other things to do, so I'll take care of this on Chol HaMoed. I'll clean out the garage on Chol HaMoed. No, we shouldn't set it up that way. So the third chapter starts with some of the things you're allowed to do on Chol HaMoed because he didn't have a chance to do them before. So it starts off Eilam Agalchim, because you're not supposed to shave and trim your beard on Chol HaMoed, because you should have done that for Yom Tov. Now, many poskim, modern poskim, say this is talking about a society where everyone has a beard. And if you don't trim for Yom Tov, you're not going to look well-kempt. But if someone is totally clean shaven all the time, because they use a Norelco, a new device that allows us to remove facial hair according to the halacha without a razor. So if we indeed have such a situation, then you should probably shave during Chol HaMoed. Otherwise you look scraggly. You look unkempt for the last days of Yom Tov. Right? Okay. So, according to this, if Rabbeinu Tam says that if I shaved before Yom Tov, if I trimmed my beard before Yom Tov, I can trim it again during Chol HaMoed. Right? This is Rabbeinu Tam's lamdus. And Tosfos disagrees, then the Shulchan Aruch disagrees, because the Mishnah should have listed this among those who can shave on Chol HaMoed. It lists someone who got out of jail during Chol HaMoed, someone who got out of a neder during Chol HaMoed, someone who's finished his avelus right before Yom Tov but didn't have a chance to shave, or someone who left Cherim during Chol HaMoed, or left Nazirus if his term of Nazirus ended during Chol HaMoed. So all of these people didn't have a chance to take care of that before. Okay. As a tangent to this, amazingly, because a lot of the things we don't do during Chol HaMoed are similar to the things we don't do in the week of Shiva, the end of Meseches Moed Katan talks a lot about the laws of Avelus. It's a tangent to Chol HaMoed. And that, if you recall, connected to Yevamos, which the Moed Katan really ends Moed, and then Yevamos continues with a similar theme, because the whole essence of Yibam is that someone died without children. So that's how Moed Katan moves into Yevamos. Okay, that means that we finished Bava Basra. That means that our next time we'll be doing Maseches Sanhedrin. Look forward to that very much. And everyone should be well. Kol b'seder, and stay well and stay healthy, everybody. Kol tov,
everyone. Thank you.